This is Audible.
Hey House Audio is pleased to present Crossing Over, the stories behind the stories, written and read by John Edward.
This is an audiobook about crossing over, not just the television show. Not just the metaphysical process that inspired the TV show. To be sure, you'll hear a lot about both the show and the process. But this audiobook is also a chronicle of personal transition. It seems like a lifetime ago, and it seems like last week, that I was a young suburban newlywed with a job at a hospital computer department and some unusual part-time activities. Even as recently as 1999, I was doing readings in my home, and you had to be pretty plugged into the psychic world to know who I was. 2 years later, I'm on TV 5 nights a week and reading about myself in newspaper and magazine stories with headlines like, "My next guest is dead." I'm a media medium who not too long ago had stage fright on the radio. Talk about crossing over. This is the story of that wild ride. If you have read any books by or about psychic mediums, including my own, you will notice that this is not like the others. Now, no disrespect intended, some of them are excellent books by fine mediums, and I have to thank them for paving the way. But I intend this book to break new ground, not only in demystifying the process of spirit communication, which is my whole reason for doing my work so publicly, but in offering a glimpse of the world that I live in. Now I want you to know how things look from inside my head, because I've got to say, you have no idea what it's like being a psychic medium these days. I hope after listening to this audiobook, you might. That's why you'll find me discussing some difficult and controversial questions: money, motivation, celebrity, and the private and public battles I have to confront in my work. These are issues I can't avoid if I'm going to stand up and do what I do in front of television cameras. This book was written in collaboration with Richard Firstman, an author and journalist with whom I wrote my first nonfiction book, One Last Time. I realized that some of these stories are so extraordinary, even to me, that a skeptic could be forgiven for being, well, skeptical. That's why we've both felt it was important for Rick, an accomplished reporter and a skeptic himself by nature, to completely and independently verify everything in this book. In all cases, we present here an accurate portrayal of my experiences without embellishment or exaggeration. One final word. I know you picked up this audiobook either intentionally or by what you might consider chance, but I don't subscribe to coincidence, so I believe that you are listening to this book because you are seeking a higher understanding of life after death. Most likely because you have had a difficult loss in your life and want to know about the possibility of spirit communication. But it's vital to understand that connecting with the other side cannot take the place of the natural grieving process. You still must confront and accept the physical loss of that person. As beneficial as it might be to connect with the loved one on the other side, even through a medium or on your own, it is imperative that you honor yourself and that loved one by grieving for them properly. That might mean listening to this audiobook only after you have sought out a counselor, a member of the clergy, or a friend. Only after you have accepted the loss can true healing begin. I hope that what you find here is helpful to you on your path of learning and for your own soul's progression. And as I am a continuing student of this field, now you are too. May the student in you become the teacher for another. Prologue. Unitel Studios, New York City, June 14th, 2000. I'm standing in shadows, waiting to walk out in front of 100 people and explain that I'm about to connect some of them with their departed relatives. To your side means husbands, wives, brothers, sisters, above you, parents, grandparents, appreciate the messages, just answer yes or no. I've given this litany 1,000 times before, in living rooms and offices and Holiday Inns in states I can't even locate on a map. But this is different. This is like nothing I've ever done before. It's not something I've ever really aspired to, but here I am. Across the dimly lit set, I see Doug Fogel watching me. He's the stage manager. He's in control of what's happening, unlike the person he's looking at, the person whose name is actually in the title of the show. Doug hears the cue from the control room over his headset and begins counting me down with one hand. 5, 4, 3, 2. He points to the irregularly shaped white screen that plays the opening montage of the show. He looks at the audience, extends his arms, and begins clapping with a purpose, turning himself into a human applause sign. And then he points to me, and it's showtime. Time for me to walk out from side stage, make a quick left as I reach the middle of the screen, and bound onto the illuminated disc that will be my new home. Something tells me we're not in the Holiday Inn anymore, Toto. As I scan the audience, the gallery as it's being called, I try to smile the way I think a TV host is supposed to smile. And I'm not comfortable. Actually, I am extremely uncomfortable. I'm not wearing clothes, I'm wearing wardrobe. I have makeup on. There's all this stuff around me. Up above, there's a constellation of lights. Over here, a contraption that looks vaguely like a camera. And there's like an entire industry of people laboring over a cosmic version of something I've been doing for years by myself. Up until now, I've been pretty much okay with just God's help. Now I'm relying on Doug. Everywhere I look, there are people in headsets talking to the producers and the director who's in a room somewhere staring at 52 television screens with my face on more of them than really seems necessary. It's called the control room. And now that makes me nervous. Because I'm a control freak, just ask anybody. And I don't like surrendering so much control that they might need an entire room to hold it. Will I be able to do what I do under these conditions? Was this really such a good idea? How the hell did I get here? Great Expectations. A psychic in ladies' lingerie. I was not a happy medium in 1998. An example. Denver in November. I'm near the end of a 2-week City a Day tour to promote my first nonfiction book, One Last Time. At a book signing, I spoke for about 20 minutes, then asked if anybody had any questions. A woman raised her hand. "Can you start over?" she asked. "You talk way too fast." Well, it's been that kind of tour right from the start. Back in New York, the publicity people booked me at a Bradley's department store in the ladies' underwear section. "Attention, shoppers, come see the psychic in ladies' lingerie on the lower level." I'm standing among the bras and panties talking about dead people. My spirit guides, which I call the boys, must have one fine sense of humor. Yeah, they're just hilarious. No, things are not going well. In a town on Long Island where I live, I went to a bookstore and they tried to sell me James Van Praagh's latest book. The sales clerk said it was way better than the one by that John Edwards guy. And this one by Sylvia Brown's good, too. I ask if she's read the one by the Edwards guy. She says no. I introduce myself. It doesn't help. It's still Edwards to her. There have been worse days lately. Last month, Montel Williams and Larry King canceled my appearance on the same day, which actually was my birthday. Definitely a message from the boys. But what were they trying to tell me? The Larry King people said that they would reschedule, but the Montel producer said that, well, I've been there and done that. Just yet another psychic guy who talks to the dead, so what else is new? They need a new angle, but I don't think I have one. Somewhere on the road, it hit me like a punch in the face. Things are not turning out as I thought that they would. No, as I knew they would. Go ahead, say it. Some psychic you are. I was about to turn 30, and I could look back across the years and see where I came from and how I got here. And I had thought I could see around the bend because my spirit guides had given me glimpses. They had told me years earlier that I would be a teacher in this field. What they didn't tell me was when or how. I would have to find that out on my own. Not that they didn't shine a light, because they always had. Years ago, the summer I was 14, my Aunt Joan took me on my first real excursion, a cruise to the Caribbean. Docking in St. Thomas, we spent hours shopping, eating, and walking along the shore. Mostly walking, and walking, and walking. After 7 or 8 hours, we thought it might be a good idea to turn around and head back. About 20 minutes into our return hike, my feet tired and burning, I looked across the horizon and saw our ship in the far distance, about 1/2 inch wide in my perception. "Oh my God," I said, "look at how far we still have to go." My aunt laughed, reminded me of something her mother, my paternal grandmother Mary, used to always say. "Don't look at how far you have to go. Look at how far you've already come." My grandmother's favorite saying was prophetic. She didn't know she was passing down from her daughter to her grandson nothing less than words to live by. Trying to look too far ahead, worrying how and when and even if you're going to get where you're supposed to go, can stop you in your tracks. It's a lesson I would have done well to remember 15 years later. There was irony in this because I had spent a lot of effort recalling my earliest years for the opening chapters of One Last Time. How as a young child, I had experiences that only years later would I realize were not part of the average childhood. How I knew things I shouldn't have known, family events that had happened before I was born that no one had told me about. It wasn't until I was a teenager, after an encounter with a psychic named Lydia Clarke, that I began to explore what was going on inside my head. And by college, I was spending my free time as a psychic medium. But I never considered psychic medium as a viable career choice. It never even entered my mind. Imagine putting that on your tax return. Well, I got a degree in public administration and went to work at a large hospital, first as a phlebotomist drawing patients' blood, and later in the computer department. I continued doing private and group readings at night and on weekends and developed a small following around Long Island. But I envisioned a fulfilling upward career in healthcare administration and a normal life. I married my dance instructor and we bought a house on a quiet cul-de-sac. By 1995, my spirit guides were pushing me to change course in their direction. They were leading me to the understanding that I was on a path to a life's work connecting the physical world to the spirit world. But I didn't leap into it. I loved my job at the hospital and had serious reservations about building my life around my psychic work. For one thing, I was very insecure about how people would perceive me. Well, what do you do? Oh, I talk to dead people. But the stakes were even higher than that. What my guides were telling me was that I would be more than a practitioner. I would be some sort of noted figure in the field, and that I would help a lot of people. Go ahead, roll your eyes. Who is this guy, some possessed cult leader? But as pompous as that might sound, it wasn't anything that I had aspired to. I had no interest in being well-known. In fact, it's still not important to me. Celebrity is fleeting. It's the work that endures, if you're doing it right. I had a major life decision to make. Stay with the job and career I loved, and the financial security that came with it, or cross over into a peculiar blend of spiritualism and entrepreneurship. I had always followed my guides, and they had never steered me wrong. That year, I made the biggest leap of faith of my life. I left the hospital and actually did put down psychic medium as my occupation on my tax return. I gave private readings in my home office, group readings in the living room, and started giving lectures to larger groups in hotel meeting rooms. Even those who had heard I was young were taken aback when they saw me. This 20-something guy in jeans and a t-shirt who was now going to unite them with their departed loved ones. You did not need to be psychic to know what they were thinking. He's a kid. Well, not long after I left the hospital, my guides let me know that I needed to begin working on a book. My human reaction was puzzlement. Who wants to read a book by a 26-year-old kid who says he has special access to the other side? Well, this became a persistent refrain, so I took it pretty much as a given. No more complicated than following a bear right road sign without having to slow down, as if just following someone's instructions. I started thinking about it, making notes of the points I wanted to make in the book, and the stories I wanted to tell. I started keeping a file of letters that validated past clients' readings. I didn't have an agent, and I wondered if I should get some help writing it. But my boys, the guides, told me specifically, no, that I would do it by myself. I didn't find this surprising or a daunting prospect. I felt I was a good writer, and I was encouraged by the confidence boost my guides were giving me. Then one night in February of 1996, something very unusual happened. They slammed on the brakes and did a screeching U-turn. You need help with the book. Well, this confused me. It was very odd for my guides to tell me one thing, stay with that for more than a year, and then suddenly do a 180. I wasn't sure why my guides were suddenly leading me in a different direction, but I wasn't going to argue with them. They're called guides for a reason. The next night, a slender woman with long dark hair came to my house for a private reading. Her name was Jamie, and when we sat down for the reading, I felt the kind of positive, open energy around her that makes my job so much easier and a lot more fun. If this story starts to sound familiar, it's because I told it in One Last Time. But not completely. Jamie was called Randy there, and for reasons that will become apparent, the context of the story was removed. I simply presented it as an intriguing and memorable reading, which it was. But I left out the ending, which was for me the most important thing about it. Almost from the start, Jamie's reading was like an unfolding book. Interestingly enough, as it turned out, I was getting information with clarity and detail, Jamie brought a notebook and began scribbling as names started coming quickly. Not just the usual sounds or initials, but complete, unmistakable names. The reading continued for more than an hour, and after Jamie's family pulled back, she and I began to talk. We were both intrigued by what had taken place. "You know," Jamie said now, "I'm a science writer, so I'm skeptical by nature, but I've always believed in this. I know that my brother has come to me. My husband doesn't seem to believe in any of this. He wasn't too happy I was coming. He thinks this is all a bunch of baloney." "What does he do?" I asked, not something I normally ask a client. "Well, he's a writer too." At that instant, it was like my guides were saying, "Ta-da!" Without even a second's hesitation, without asking what kinds of things he wrote or knowing if he was any good or even stopping to consider that Jamie had just said that he thinks I'm full of shit, I said, "That's why you're here. Your husband is going to help me write my book." Jamie let out a big laugh. "I don't think so," she said. "You've got the wrong guy." I love Larry. One 40-page proposal later, I started making the rounds of New York publishers with my new writing partner. Guess who? Jamie had gone home that night and read from her notebook, and a few days later, her husband was sitting in my living room observing a group reading that, as I had warned it might, included a few stray messages for him. Rick was indeed a confirmed non-believer when we met. A when-you're-dead-you're-dead kind of guy with a lifelong fear of the great abyss that Woody Allen would be proud to own. But now Rick was undergoing a readjustment in the metaphysics department. I told Rick how I believed our collaboration had been arranged, how my guides had been telling me I would write the book myself. And then suddenly reversing field, going back over the events, we realized that on that very Sunday night that they had given me the new plan, I got a call on my office answering machine from someone scheduled to have a reading the next night. She couldn't make the appointment. I called the next person on my waiting list to see if she could grab a late opening the following night. And that, of course, was Jamie. Now it all made sense. My guides had not really reversed themselves. They had merely orchestrated the timing. They wanted to prepare me to write a book, but if they had told me everything at the outset, I would have been sidetracked by the plan. I would have spent too much energy looking for the person I was supposed to work with rather than doing what I needed to be doing, diving into the swim of being a full-time medium, gathering experience, and without the crutch of a collaborator, envisioning the book. Thinking it out, writing an outline, keeping notes. If they had to deceive me to get me ready, I couldn't argue with their shrewdness, because now I was ready. Visiting some of the big publishing houses that expressed interest in our proposal, I knew there would be polite requests for me to read the editors who would be deciding whether to buy the book. It didn't strike me as unreasonable, and I read anyone who asked. We had some nibbles, but nobody was beating down any doors for the honor of publishing the memoirs and collected wisdom of a 27-year-old psychic from Long Island. Not coincidentally, the best reading I gave was around a conference table with a group of editorial sales and marketing people at the company that eventually bought the book, an imprint of Penguin Putnam called Berkeley Books. It was about equal to the starting salary of a public school teacher, all of which went toward the expense of getting the book written. While working on the book on and off over the next year or so, I continued trying to follow the path my guides had laid out for me, to be something more than a neighborhood psychic. I had actually taken the first steps years earlier, while still working at the hospital. One morning in 1994, a colleague of mine named Pat had come up to my office and informed me that I had to call WPLJ, a popular radio station in New York City. "Right away," Pat said. "Scott and Todd have a psychic on, and she gave Naomi bad news." Naomi DiClemente was the morning jock's sidekick, the darling of the show, loved by all, and the butt of many jokes. Well, apparently this psychic had told Naomi that she should cancel her wedding. Pat wanted me to call up the station and uncast this evil psychic spell. "I'm not going to do that," I said. "I can't call up a strange woman on the radio and say, 'You don't know me, but I'm a psychic too, and...'" Pat interrupted me and said, "Would you like someone to do that to Sandra?" Sandra and I had just gotten engaged. And I freaked. And I called. I left 4 messages, including the last one with someone in the office who actually hung up on me, saying Naomi had heard enough from psychics for one day. But Naomi DiClemente called me back, sounding nervous, but apparently in desperate need of a good psychic of the East to counteract the bad psychic of the North. So there I sat at my desk in the hospital computer department, asking Naomi how the psychic had performed her reading. Did she use astrology? No. Numerology or cards? No. Naomi said none of the above. Did she say anything that was validated in any way to let you know that she was accurate at what she does? Well, no. Then why would you pay any attention to her? Naomi thanked me for calling and said that she felt better and went on to become happily married. A few months later, my friend Ernie and I went to a Tower record store in a shopping center on Long Island. He had just bought a new car and insisted on parking in the next zip code to avoid that dreaded first scratch. The long walk to the store took us past a Filene's basement where we saw that WPLJ was doing a live remote. We recognized Naomi, who was smiling, signing autographs, and posing for pictures. Naomi. She turned and looked at me. John Edward. She jumped up and gave me a big gleeful hug. One of the people from the station moved in, looking on warily, not having seen that all I did was walk up and say hello. Naomi said later she recognized my voice, although to this day I can't imagine how. All I said was, Naomi. We chatted for a few minutes, and Naomi asked, when are you coming on the show? Just the suggestion that I go on the radio on a big New York station was enough to unhinge me. Hadn't she had enough of wacko psychics anyway? I'll call you, Naomi said. Great. Naomi kept asking. I kept saying no. I called Naomi and asked her what she thought about an invitation that I had to doing a radio show in Miami. She gave me a long list of reasons why I should do it, probably figuring that it was her best shot at getting me on WPLJ. Figuring once I got my first time out of the way, I'd relax. And if I did Miami, I couldn't say no to her anymore. And if you suck, she said, laughing, it doesn't matter. It's Florida. Nobody up here will know. I went on in Miami, and it went fine. I found that I could do readings just as well over the phone as face to face. I called Naomi to tell her. Now you have to do my show, she said, and I did. After that, Naomi spoke to her colleague, Todd Pettengill, who called me and invited me on his morning show with Naomi and Scott Shannon. I said yes and immediately thought, oh God, this is New York and New Jersey, Long Island and Connecticut. I went on in August of 1995. Between my appearances on WBLI in Long Island and WPLJ in New York City, I was becoming better known. Radio is a small business, and word of mouth travels fast. Over the next year or two, I assembled a small network of stations around the country whose hosts treated me seriously, though not too seriously, and put me on the air regularly. I was not paid for any of this. It was just something I felt was worthwhile and something I enjoyed. I liked the hosts, some of whom became far-flung phone friends, and I looked forward to the occasional trips I began making to their studios. I was content with radio as my medium. I had no burning desire to be on television, even if I'd had the audacity to try. I liked the simplicity of radio, but more than that, the physical anonymity. People didn't need to know what I looked like because it wasn't about me. It was about the work. When my guides told me I would be well known, I saw it as the messages getting the attention, not me. After establishing good relationships with a few radio shows across the country, I began going on the road. I would schedule a lecture at a hotel, then fly out and do a radio show in the same city. The lectures, which I had been doing regularly in the New York area, were part seminar and part group reading. I'd get anywhere from 50 to 200 people. But I was far from a household name. By 1997, James Van Praagh had burst onto the scene with his biggest bestseller, Talking to Heaven. I was thrilled about the success of the book because it was great for the field. It introduced so many people to the idea of conscious, interactive afterlife. It brought the idea more into the mainstream, made it okay to talk about. More eyes were looking at this than ever before. When his book reached the top of the New York Times bestseller list, I called James to congratulate him. Wow, number one, I said, a book about talking to dead people. This is huge. You're making all of our lives easier. James's book was a landmark, just as Joel Martin and Patricia Romanowski's We Don't Die about medium George Anderson was in the late 1980s. But two things were different when James's book came out. One is that our society had become much more interested in examining the soul and what it means. The other thing that had changed was not so esoteric. We had become much more defined by the media and the celebrity culture. There were more TV news magazine shows tripping over each other for the same stories. There were endless entertainment and celebrity magazines and TV shows. There was cable, and the internet. Everyone knew who James was. Few knew who I was. But I had to figure, based on what I had been hearing from my guides for a while now, that this would change once the book was published. I believed that George had blazed the trail and that James had paved the road. Now I would help widen it. I wasn't being presumptuous or smug, at least I didn't feel that way. Probably just unsophisticated. Berkeley had paid little for the book and was planning to publish it in trade paperback, which, if I had known anything about the publishing world, would have given me an indication of how much they would put into marketing it. But I just believed in the book. It was human, I thought, and it was honest. Here you go, this is who I am. And these are the people I've known, and here are their experiences. And I wanted to believe I had accomplished my most important goal, demystifying my work and giving people an understanding of the process. I've always hoped that when people encounter me, whether in a private reading or in a lecture, whether it's their first time or their 10th, they leave with a new perspective about spirit communication. By the spring of 1998, the book was finished and set to be published in the fall. I couldn't wait. It would reach so many more people than I ever could through lectures. I also liked the fact that with a book, there was still a measure of anonymity in a funny way. And with that, I hoped, would come something I craved. Credibility. For as long as I had been working professionally as a psychic medium, my goal was to be respected by my peers and for my work to be understood and accepted by the public. There was no denying I had chosen a field tainted by the stereotypes of phonies and flakes and ridiculed by cynics. If you were prominent enough to be written about in newspapers or magazines, it usually meant they were going to make fun of you. What other profession deals with such a profound subject and is taken less seriously? In my mind, a book was a way for me to take some control of how I and the whole idea of spirit communication was perceived. And it meant that I had attained a certain stature. A book was something you could hold in your hands and keep on your bookshelf. It wasn't going to be lining someone's birdcage. To have the prestige and credibility of a major publishing company behind me meant that smart, careful people believed in me. At least my editor and the people I worked closely with believed in me. I'm not sure what the people at the top believed. Other than that, whether I was talking to the dead or not, I was convincing enough to sell books. And make no mistake, selling books is what I wanted to do. I saw no reason to be embarrassed about seizing this opportunity to be paid as much money as I honestly could for my hard work. I am no different from anyone else. I only had to make sure of one thing. Money could be a byproduct of what I do, but it could not be the reason. If I let the balance tip, if money became my driving force, I would have problems. It was a lesson I had to learn over and over and over and over. If I had a mortgage payment due and saw 5 readings on my calendar, that would get me over the top. Well, all 5 would wind up canceling. To get the book out there, I knew I would have to essentially stop earning my living and focus all my energies on promoting it. The publicity department said I would have to get on television. I didn't wait for them to do it. I started calling people who knew people. I made calls to talk show producers. I sent out promotional tapes. It seemed that after James Van Prague went on Larry King twice within a couple of months, he started his phenomenal rise to the top of the New York Times bestseller list. I figured Larry was a good place for me to start, especially since a close friend of mine had a brother who was a top-ranking executive at CNN. Larry seemed to like mediums. I went on one night in June, 4 months before the book was due out. I did well enough with Larry to leave with an invitation to come back when the book was actually out. A few days later, the publisher decided to publish one last time in hardcover. The Power of Larry King, my first lesson learned. The book arrived in November of 1998. The publisher sent me to the big cities and others where I had relationships with radio stations. I would go on the air, do some readings, and horse around with the morning drive hosts, then appear at local bookstores. I had made friends with a woman named Rami Warren Black, a veteran talk show producer who had recently left the Lisa Show to start a media consulting business. She made some calls and helped get me on the one-named TV host circuit. Roseanne, Maury, Donnie Marie. Catherine Cryer, a former judge, had me on her show and was amazingly honest and objective about a topic that was risky for her to embrace. After they preempted me on my birthday, the Larry King producers offered me a night when Larry would be away, the day before Halloween. His fill-in would be Greta Van Susteren, CNN's legal analyst. I said sure. She would do an interesting interview, and she did. She asked me about my burden of proof. Do Do publishers have spirit guides? After this whirlwind tour, after all the national television exposure, I was sure the book would take off. This just in from the boys. Surprise! Not happening. One of the standard caveats I give people before I do readings is to leave their expectations at the door. Whatever happens, happens, and for a reason. Value whatever you get, even if it's not what you wanted or anticipated. Well, I should have remembered that myself, but I was clueless. One Last Time was going nowhere, at least by the standard of my own inflated expectations, and I saw nothing to appreciate in that message. Was I naive? Arrogant? Maybe both. But mostly, I was too caught up in the big sell to realize that my guides would not stand for it. Yes, they protect me, but sometimes that means protecting me from myself. I have a rock in my desk, a paperweight, that says, trust. It has a very specific meaning for me. I don't easily trust people. I have learned to always trust my guides. I just need to remember that sometimes their schedule is not necessarily the same as mine. As far as I can tell, publishing conglomerates don't have spirit guides. The sales and marketing people thought they might have made a mistake by using my title. One Last Time was too generic, they thought, not memorable or to the point enough. You had to read the book to know that One Last Time alluded to a wish I had shared with my mom many years ago, that people should have one last time to connect with their loved ones, not just before they passed, but after they passed. I didn't think the title was the problem. I liked the title. It meant a lot to me. But it wasn't a title that was on a lot of people's lips. The Berkeley people may well have considered the book a success. They paid me only a small advance, so they didn't have to sell a huge number of books to make money. Then they could push the paperback, which is what they had in mind in the first place. I had always suspected they didn't have great expectations for me anyway. Through its various imprints, Berkeley's huge parent company, Penguin Putnam, published all the established psychic stars, Sylvia Brown, James Van Prague, and George Anderson. I was the rookie, trying to break into the big leagues. My editor was wonderfully supportive and enthusiastic, but she couldn't get books in the stores any more than I could. I tried not to dwell too much on the disappointment, still holding out a glimmer of hope that word of mouth would somehow build slowly but surely enough to get the book off the ground. Meanwhile, thanks to a friend, Rick Korn, I had some other things going on that distracted me from my frustrations and kept me going. I'd met Rick only a year earlier, but we had clicked immediately, and he had wasted no time trying to help me broaden my horizons. It was the phone call to his brother at CNN that first got me on Larry King Live. I had made a video version of One Last Time that was ready before the book was. Rick thought I should use the Larry King opportunity to sell it. Everyone who goes on there promotes something, a movie, a TV show, a book, he said. Why not you? Rick set up a phone bank through a telemarketing company where he had once worked. The night of the show, Larry held up the tape and the producers were nice enough to flash the number on the screen. I don't know how many people wanted the video, but enough calls came in to crash the phone bank. Most people got busy signals. A few thousand people did get through and place their orders. But the company we hired to duplicate and ship the tapes, well, there's no other way to put this, they ripped us off. They took the money twice or three times from some customers and did not send out the tapes. Some people threatened legal action, and they're probably still out there thinking it was some sort of television scam. We had to scramble to get a new company to get these tapes out, and we had to pay for priority shipping. The whole debacle cost me a lot of money, about the starting salary of two public school teachers. Meanwhile, I was having problems with the freelance producer who had made the video. We had met in 1997 after I gave a talk at Starchild Books, a new age store in Florida owned by Sandy Anastasi, the only person in this field who can actually claim to be a teacher of mine. This producer came up to me and said, "We should do a video together." I wasn't interested. He kept calling, saying how much money we'd make. I told him to go away. Then he came back with a different pitch. "Think of how many people will hear your message." I bought it. While putting the video together, he was all about what a beautiful thing this was, how important this was, how it would touch so many people. Looking back, though, he seems to have been in it more for the money. Fortunately, an infomercial that I was involved with to sell these tapes never saw the light of day or night, aside from a few small test markets where it went over like a pitch for a treadmill that only goes backwards. It did not convey who I was or what I do. It was disjointed and unconvincing. It was what you might expect, a sitcom-length commercial for soul survival. My guides gave it 2 thumbs way, way down. "I can't believe it," Rick said. "This should have been a grand slam." The marketing company wanted to recut it and make it edgier. I told them to forget it. I wondered if my guides just did not want these people to make any money from me. And maybe the boys thought I could do better. I couldn't imagine how this could possibly fit into the universal plan I thought I was following. But it did. I was just too close to see it. Perspective is everything. Life's a bitch, and then you don't die. I have a simple philosophy about the whole idea of destiny and choice. If you meet with obstacles, you try to overcome them. You fix what you need to fix to reach what you believe is your goal. If you still can't fix it, if you're hitting a wall, it probably means you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. Change careers, change direction. You're meant to be doing something else. For me, the wall was this. I was playing by the rules, at least I thought I was, and yet I was becoming weighed down by some of the nastiest energy I'd ever known. The downside of the information age is that the bad stuff is impossible to control. It spreads like a retrovirus. All of a sudden, people I'd never met were attacking me with a vengeance on psychic message boards and Amazon.com. Most of the comments on Amazon were very, very positive, but of course, I focused on the negative ones. That the book was cookie-cutter, new-age stuff, or worse. That I was a fraud preying on gullible, grieving people using stories that were obviously fabricated. Taking the hits in stride had been a struggle for as many years as I'd been a medium. But now I was a bigger target, even if my book was a flop. I didn't read the criticism on my computer, but people faxed me printouts. Hey, thanks for thinking of me. I tried to shrug them off. But it was infuriating that these internet critics, the kind of people who give free speech a bad name, were telling the world that the stories in the book were made up when I knew they were completely true, verified by a respected journalist and written without any exaggeration. After the book tour, I came home and got back to doing private readings. I would read someone in my office and the person would let me know she was disappointed that her son didn't come through or that I didn't get her husband's name. Or I would have what I thought was a great session with someone, both on a professional and personal level, and 2 days later I would go to my mailbox and find a scathing letter from that same person, who had apparently decided after leaving my office that it was outrageous that I charge money for what I do. These kinds of attacks were not new to me, nor was my own dismal reaction. A particularly wounding comment or incident or a personal attack on my integrity was entirely capable of putting me out of commission for a couple of days, but I'd gotten better at letting the shots whiz past my ear. Usually with the help of a nice letter from a happy client telling me how much peace and comfort her reading had brought. But now I was finding it harder to climb out of the hole. I'd never been this chewed up. The closest I'd come was in the spring of 1997, at a time when I was stressed out about the physical and emotional demands of my work and feeling a little sorry for myself. Now, 2 years later, I began to think that not only was I hitting a wall, but there might be handwriting on it. I withdrew from my wife Sandra and from my friends. Rick Korn called me and I could barely talk to him. I had nothing to say. I will never forget this night. I'm sitting back in my chair, sneakers off, as usual, when I do private readings. I'm alone in my office after finishing the last reading of the night. It's about 10 o'clock. I look down at my white socks. They're worn from walking around without shoes. I wonder if my client saw them. They're probably thinking, the guy's charging $200 for a reading. The least he could do is have clean socks. And then I sit back in the chair some more and I finally say to myself, I'm done. I add it all up. I'm having the longest period of discontentment I've had as a medium. I haven't had a worse 6 months since my mother's dying days. I'm tired all the time. I'm expending a lot of energy and not getting a whole lot in return. The past 6 months have been a paradox. With all the exposure I've had, I'm getting more attention, more letters and more phone calls than ever before. But I'm not making enough money to be anything but a one-person operation. I don't want to raise my fees. I have a rule I wouldn't break. I only charge what I would pay. I was so sure the book would be my big turning point. Maybe it was. I went to school for nearly 5 years, got within a few credits of a master's. I can do something else. It's time to move on to the next thing. The phone rings, and it's my best friend Mark. He and I have been friends since the age of 12, back when I was telling teachers about their auras. Even 20 years later, we're like tight brothers. "What's going on?" Mark asked. "I'm not doing this anymore," I told Mark. "Okay, what's wrong?" Mark wasn't new to any of this. He'd seen me completely sapped, zombie-faced, and shut down after lectures. I'd go into a 2-hour zone-out, fall asleep, then bounce back the next morning. And he'd also seen me do my share of dwelling on perceived slights. Now I gave him the "I don't feel appreciated" speech, which he'd heard before. He gave me the "but you bring a lot of comfort to people" speech, which I'd heard before. "This is different," I said. "I think I want to do something else." "Really?" Mark said. "I don't want to deal with people." "Well, what would you do instead?" I had been thinking about when I was the happiest with what I was doing, and it was back in the hospital. It was when I was drawing blood. What I loved was connecting with the patients. I would see them before and after their surgeries, and I felt like I could affect their lives in a positive way, calming their nerves with some encouraging words, a gentle tease, or just a smile at the right time. When I was 19, just a couple of years before I began working in the hospital, I had spent day after day at my mom's bedside as she lay dying of cancer that had been diagnosed just a few months before. Now I felt as if every patient I saw was my mother. Every person who came in to visit was me. To make it a little easier for them was tremendously rewarding. Now that was appreciated, and I missed it, and I still do. "Well, then you should go back to the hospital," Mark said. "Go back to healthcare." But I didn't want to go back to the hospital. I wanted to return to the feeling of contentment I'd had, but not to the actual job. The hospital was filled with, you know, people. I'd recently added a second Bichon Frise to our family. Now Jolie had a little sister, Roxy. Sandra and I refer to them as the girls. And I love those dogs. "I'm going to vet school," I told Mark. My three signs. Princess. My mother was a major force in my life, and she always seemed to be closely connected with everything psychic that happened to me. She introduced me to it as a child in a gradual, unthreatening way. And later, when I got a glimpse of my abilities, she gently encouraged me to develop them. When I had questions about the meaning of it all, she helped me answer them, even if she sometimes didn't even know that's what she was doing. But her biggest lessons of all came at the end of her life and in the dozen years since she has been on the other side. Her given name was Perinda, but everybody called her Prin, short for princess, a nickname given to her when she was only a few days old. A nurse thought that she looked like a little princess in her bassinet, and the name stuck. My mother's family moved from Brooklyn out to Glen Cove, Long Island, where she was a teenager. A decade later, she met and then married Jack McGee, who later became a city cop and career military reservist. They moved back over the city line to Queens, where I was born. I was christened John Edward McGee. So to answer the question, yes, John Edward is my real name, just not my full name at birth. But it is now. I no longer answer to McGee. And for the record, it's Edward, not Edwards. So back to my mother. She worked for 17 years as a secretary and office manager at a factory that made typewriter ribbons and carbon paper. Then she moved to a job in Manhattan. She was the office manager for a multi-million dollar venture capital firm responsible for keeping things running on 6 floors of offices. By that point, she and my father were separated, and Mom and I were living with my grandmother on Long Island, in the house where my mother had lived as a teenager. My grandmother instilled in me a great sense of family, always having big parties with lots of music in what came to be known as the dancing room. But as tight as my bonds have always been to the maternal side of the family, I have not been able to match that closeness with my father or much of his family. This isn't easy, given my philosophy of life. A few years ago, recognizing that I was always telling people to appreciate and validate their loved ones who had passed, I realized I should expand the message to the obvious. We shouldn't focus so much on communicating with those on the other side that we neglect to appreciate and validate the people in our lives on this side. But of course, Sometimes, despite the best of intentions, that's not possible. The simple answer in my case is that my father and I have never been able to be close for whatever reasons of personality, distance, and experience. My closeness with my mother's side, especially my grandmother and aunts, developed naturally after my parents split up. With my mother off at work in the city, my grandmother was the one who looked after me when I got home from school. I'd come home through the door and find her in the same spot every day, crocheting and watching the soaps from a chair between the living room and dining room. And I do mean soaps. She would have two TVs on. One, a big old RCA console with family photos sitting on top, would be slightly turned toward the dining room and tuned to Another World on Channel 4. And the other, the hottest new Zenith, was turned toward the living room and tuned to Guiding Light on Channel 2. My grandmother sat in the middle and actually watched and followed both shows simultaneously, her head moving back and forth as if she were watching a tennis match from center court. Eventually, my grandmother gave up on Another World. We would sit there on the couch, Granny and I, watching the impossibly complicated goings-on in Springfield. My mom, the family breadwinner, would take the bus home and walk through the door precisely at 6:30 p.m. each evening. She'd be tired after a long day at the office and not in too good a mood. You did not talk to her. You waited for her to talk to you first. Everyone was much better off that way. But that was just her. You had to accept that it wasn't always sunshine and rose petals around my mother. But she was as fiercely devoted as a mother as anyone could have been. All the more so because it had become clear that I would have a minimal relationship with my father and his family. Now here's a little thing that tells you a lot. I was a pudgy kid, the one who always got picked last in choose-up games. My mother would take me shopping at Mays and JCPenney's department stores, and I noticed that before she sent me into the dressing room to try on pants or jackets, she would surreptitiously rip a tag from each one. I found later that these were the tags that had said, Husky. She didn't want me to see them. Well, for a long time, I thought my mother was also a nut. It was the psychic thing. She was always going to psychics and psychic fairs, having psychic house parties, and my father wanted no part of it, and wanted me to have no part of it either. You just make sure Johnny's not home when you bring these people over here, he'd tell her. And that was just fine with me. She wasn't into mediums. I only remember hearing the word seance once as a child. My mom's brother Joey had invited a medium by the name of Reverend Craig to my grandmother's house for a seance. I was thrown out of the room for being a child. This 5-foot, small-framed, white-haired medium put her finger in my face and told me to leave, that I would have enough time for this later in my life. An interesting statement given my career choice. But beyond that, I never heard the word until I was a teenager. My mom wanted to know about the here and now, and if you don't mind, a little bit about next week, and if possible, anything important in the next 20 years or so. As I got older, I would tease her about being a psychic junkie. But besides finding her obsession inane, I found it irritating as hell. Mom, I'd say, these are con artists. They're taking your money. And for what? To tell you about your life? You're living your life. Predict your future? Okay, Mom, sure. Whatever you say. When I was 15, my mother's latest psychic came to our house and read various members of the family in my bedroom. Her name was Lydia Clar. And from the living room, I'd hear my aunts and cousins go into my room and shut the door. And then the door would open a little while later and the next one would go in. One after another, all night long. When my cousin Roseanne came out, she came over to me and said, John, she's good. You should get a reading. No thanks, Ro. But she badgered me until I said, okay. And looking back at it now, there was no way my guides would have let Lydia leave our house that night without reading me. She was their messenger. I wasn't in the room 2 minutes when Lydia told me that I was the reason she was here. You have highly evolved spiritual guides and they are ready to work with you, she said. I was sent here to introduce you to this world, to open you to your future. Well, you can imagine how that went over. Psychic shtick, right? Oh, brother. But when Lydia sat in my bedroom and told me I was destined to become a famous psychic, I thought she was laying it on just a bit too heavy. I didn't even think that she could do this, and I'm supposed to believe her when she says that I can? But I figured I'd play along. Lydia told me some things about my family that were true, but I dismissed them as either lucky guesses or just a trick. She could have known all of it from talking to my mother. That was my mindset. Always picking apart the things that psychics were telling my mother at all those psychic fairs she had gone to on the weekends. But then Lydia talked about some things in my life that she couldn't have known, and about events that would happen in the future. Within a few weeks, everything she said would happen did happen. Nothing momentous, teenage stuff mostly. I had to admit I was curious. What's this all really about? I started reading about spiritualism and psychic phenomena. This is weird, I thought. The books described all the things that I thought were normal, things I've been doing ever since I could remember. When I asked my mother about the possibility of my being psychic, she told me, "Well, you know, I've always told you that you were special." "You had to say that. You're my mother." She laughed and said, "I didn't mean it as your mother. I was talking about your abilities. You know how when you're young, you open your mind to something and then all of a sudden you're really into it?" Well, it was that squared. When I get involved in something, I get involved. It was as if I was being introduced to a new person, and it was me. I was driven by a need to know who I really was. I started spending a lot of time at the library. I began studying tarot and other metaphysical philosophies with a woman named Sandy Anastasi, who ran a little psychic institute on the South Shore of Long Island. She agreed with Lydia. She invited me to a class and halfway through it said it was a waste of time for me to be there. My abilities were already too advanced for this class. She convinced me to try working at psychic fairs. I started doing psychic fairs on weekends, and I wanted to be around psychics to speak to them and learn how they worked. The most impressive one I met was a woman named Shelley Peck. She was an amazing psychic, but was also known for her astrology and mediumship, which I didn't know anything about. She had a background in psychology and also taught metaphysics and was a certified hypnotherapist who did past life regressions. That was a lot to digest, but Shelley became one of my closest friends. She was closer in age to my mother, but it didn't matter. We would talk about our work for hours at a time. Not long after I started doing psychic readings, something very weird started happening. One day I was doing a card reading for my Aunt Anna, mostly for fun because she didn't take it very seriously. As I was doing the reading, a woman appeared behind her. She was 60-ish, wearing a black dress. She had only one leg, but there was a serene smile on her face. And when I described her, my aunt said it sounded like her late mother-in-law. And then a man appeared, slender with salt and pepper hair. I didn't know who he was, and neither did my aunt. To me, it was as if these people were actually there, standing right in front of me. The images were fast and fleeting. I registered the smallest details. A flower brooch the woman was wearing, a pocket watch the man was holding. He was nattily dressed, albeit a bit out of fashion. When I asked him, in my mind, who he was, he took a barber's comb out of the pocket of his beige and blue pinstripe suit. "Oh my God, I see dead people." All right, sorry, I've just been waiting a long time to say that. And then, at the psychic fairs, I started feeling a different kind of energy. It struck me that I was doing something other than what I thought I was doing. Not that I had any idea of what I was doing. Shelley Peck and others had news for me. I was connecting with the spirit world. Oh, really? Well, this was not that interesting to me. I was a kid. I didn't want to talk to dead people. I wanted to predict people's futures, like Lydia. That was fun, and I was good at it. I was even getting a reputation for it, and people were coming to the fairs specifically to get a psychic reading from me, the kid. But over time, the people I met in the little subculture of the New York psychic circuit encouraged me to develop my skills as a medium, to take them in whatever direction was intended. And then a turning point. Shelley Peck wanted to try putting me through a past life regression. Here's what was supposed to happen. Through a series of meditations, I would be taking on a trip to a different plane of consciousness, where I could retrieve facts and essences of one or more of my soul's previous lives and convey them unconsciously to her. Sort of a cross between hypnosis, meditation, and time travel. Literally, soul searching. But the regression went in an unplanned direction. Let's just say that on the way to my past lives, we stopped off for a meet and greet with my spiritual guides, the boys, as they were destined to become known. In retrospect, I think they chose Shelley to make the introduction that day because we had such a great connection. She thought of me as her protege, this young kid always hypothesizing about the potential of our work. I saw her more as an earthly guide of sorts. Looking back, I had always felt the presence of my guides. When I felt this presence, I didn't know it was my guides, of course. I didn't know who they were or why they were there. I didn't feel any particular guidance. I just felt that someone was looking in on what I was doing. 5 or 6 of them, in fact. Now, we had finally been introduced. My mother was thrilled that I had come into the fold. I was now officially one of them. she became a psychic stage mother, bragging to her friends and relatives about her son, the psychic. More than a few relatives thought she was ridiculous, no less ridiculous than her son. She assured them that I would be famous someday. Until I was 19, I regarded my psychic work and mediumship as kind of a hobby. I was just okay at it. I had a hard time keeping up with the images and the sounds. They came and went so fast, and my interpretations of the symbols were often off the mark. I wasn't that motivated to work on it and develop my abilities. But then everything changed. In April of 1989, my mother was diagnosed with terminal lung cancer. It is the mother of all understatements to say it knocked me off balance. I kept my sorrow, my panic, tightly under wraps. I wanted to stay strong for her. One day, a few months after my mother was diagnosed, when it was evident that she would not survive the year, we began to talk about her transition to the other side. The sense I had gotten from my early experience doing readings as a medium was that the other side was all about peace. None of the things that troubled you on Earth mattered anymore, and it made you feel, maybe not superior, but promoted to a way more advanced level, maybe even the difference between kindergarten and graduate school. Evolved, to use a cliche. It was like a variation of one of those self-help mantras from the 70s. I'm okay, you're worried about the will. But of course, nobody on this side could know for sure if this was true, or if everyone had such a blissful existence once they were liberated from their earthly shackles. We couldn't know what the trip was like until we took it ourselves, and we couldn't know what life was like in that form until our time came to live it. We could only surmise and hope and devise from that a belief system we could live with. After all, maybe we only heard from the happy ones. A scary implication for everyone else. I made my mother promise she would come through to tell me she was safe. "Johnny," she said reassuringly, "when I get to the other side, I will talk to you all the time." I told her it wasn't that simple. I knew too much, and I would be hurting. How could I distinguish between an actual spirit message and a thought conceived from my own emotional need? I was a medium. I needed to be objective to do my work. This would be like a surgeon operating on himself.